content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the March 14th, 2014 edition of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. A Cold War standoff in Crimea. What happened? Russia and the West were locked in a Cold War-like standoff this week after 16,000 Russian troops seized control of Ukraine's strategic Crimean Peninsula. President Obama accused Russian President Vladimir Putin of violating international law, while Secretary of State John Kerry condemned the incursion as an incredible act of aggression that could result in visa bans, asset freezes, and the boycott of this summer's G8 summit of world leaders in Sochi. Russian forces began streaming into Crimea, home to Russia's Black Sea Fleet and a majority ethnic Russian population, just days after Ukraine's Moscow-backed President Viktor Yanukovych was ousted by pro-Western protesters and fled to Russia. Russian soldiers surrounded Ukrainian military bases in Crimea, but forces loyal to Kiev refused to surrender. "We will fight back until the last drop of our blood," said one Ukrainian commander. Putin defended his country's action as a humanitarian mission to protect ethnic Russians from rebels he claimed had illegally seized power in Kiev. But he appeared to rule out for now any intervention in eastern Ukraine, which is also home to many ethnic Russians and Russian-speaking Ukrainians. "Such a measure," he said, "would certainly be the very last resort." In Kiev, diplomats tried to forge an agreement in which pro-Russian Ukrainians would be guaranteed participation in May elections for a new government. Meanwhile, the U.S. and the European Union moved to stabilize the debt-loaded interim government, with the EU pledging $15 billion in aid over the next 2 years, on top of $1 billion in loan guarantees from Washington. What the editorial said: "Obama needs to punish Putin for this outrage, rather than issue empty threats," said the Wall Street Journal. "The U.S. should put pressure on Russia's already fragile economy by restricting its bank access to the international financial system and freezing the foreign assets of Putin's favorite oligarchs. The U.S. can also deploy ships from the Europe-based Sixth Fleet into the Black Sea. Russia should pay a price for its incursion into Crimea," said the Boston Globe. "But the U.S. has nothing to gain from reigniting the Cold War. We need Russia's cooperation on multiple fronts, including removing chemical weapons from Syria, keeping Iran from building a nuclear bomb, and withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan later this year. Crimea may be lost, so the goal of our sticks and carrots should be to make sure Putin stays out of the rest of Ukraine." What the columnist said: "If the Kremlin holds on to Crimea," said Ulrich Speck in CNN.com, "Russia will come to the conclusion that it can act like an empire. Moscow's pretext of protecting ethnic Russians could be used against former Soviet satellite states from Lithuania to Kazakhstan. Having witnessed the West's failure to defend Ukraine's sovereignty, those countries would have no choice but to submit to Russian domination. When the U.S. lectures Russia about respecting other nations' sovereignty, it has a real credibility problem," said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. "We invaded Iraq in 2003 based on false claims of weapons of mass destruction, and we're currently firing deadly missiles into Pakistan." Excuse me. What the columnist said: "Having witnessed when the U.S. Yemen and who knows where else. Sorry about that, folks. This makes it hard to base U.S. objections on principle. Let's not forget that the rebels in Kiev bear some blame for this invasion, said Dmitry Symes in NewRepublic.com. When the interim government took power last month, it eliminated Russian as an official second language, creating fear that Ukraine's new leaders were hostile to the Russian-speaking population. That needless provocation gave Putin an excuse to intervene. Despite his display of aggression, Putin is in a weak position, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. His real goal has been to restore Russia's superpower status. Now, if he doesn't back down in Ukraine, the West could eject Moscow from the G8, and other penalties will batter his already struggling economy. And by invalidating Crimea, he's alarmed the former Soviet republics he had hoped to unite in a Eurasian economic union. Putin is not as brilliant as the Cold Warriors think. A second main story. Obama sets out his 2015 budget. President Obama unveiled his 2015 budget proposal this week, calling for more spending on infrastructure, job training, and preschool education while reducing tax burdens on lower and middle class workers and closing tax loopholes that benefit the wealthy. The plan would reduce the annual deficit to $564 billion, down from $649 billion in 2014. The president's budget also calls for expanding the earned income tax credit to include low-wage workers without children, and to beef up benefits for working families. To increase revenues by $53 billion over 10 years, the plan also calls for the implementation of the Buffett Rule, imposing a minimum tax rate of 30% on individuals earning more than $1 million a year. As a country, we've got to make a decision if we're going to protect tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans or if we're going to make smart investments necessary to create jobs and grow our economy and expand opportunity for every American, Obama said. Since Congress already set spending limits through 2015 in a bipartisan deal in December, the president's budget is being seen as a blueprint for the Democrats' midterm election strategy rather than as an attainable fiscal proposal. Republicans were quick to condemn the plan, with House Speaker John Boehner calling it Obama's most irresponsible budget yet. Representative Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin, who negotiated the compromise bill with Senator Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington, called the budget a campaign brochure. What the editorial said: the president's budget won't survive congressional opposition, said the New York Times. But that doesn't make it useless. The document underscores vital national goals, reducing inequality, rebuilding the economy, that could be achieved if Congress ended unfair tax breaks for the rich. Expanding the EITC, for example, provides an incentive to work for 5.8 million newly eligible workers. Yet every dollar of the $651 billion in new revenue Obama seeks over the next decade will be resisted by Republicans. With this budget, Obama is revving up the tax and spend engines, said the Wall Street Journal, supporting inequality and class warfare. Big Democratic themes for the November elections. The budget leaves entitlement spending on cruise control, and by dropping his proposal to keep Social Security cost of living increases in check, Obama isn't even making a token outreach to the GOP. His proposals on military spending will reduce defense outlays relative to GDP to their lowest level since 1940, which will impress Vladimir Putin, though not in a good way. What the columnist said: if all budgets are political documents, Obama's is a partisan opus, said Zeke Miller in Time.com. It is chock full of wedge issues, with each proposal carefully calibrated to be individually popular. It allows Democrats to run on the populist issues without risking a vote on tax increases that Republicans could exploit. but by rescinding the offer on entitlement reform, said John Avlon in thedailybeast.com, Obama has kicked the can on fiscal reform necessary to tackle the country's looming financial problems. But expanding the EITC, closing corporate tax loopholes, and funding infrastructure are all areas of common interest, said Jonathan Cohn in newrepublic.com. Once the Ryan Murray deal expires in 2015, these proposals could be a basis for fruitful debate on the next budget. And by proposing to expand EITC benefits, Obama is effectively calling the Republicans' bluff, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Eager to shed their royalist image, Republicans have been touting increased EITC benefits as a better incentive to work than a higher minimum wage. But now that the president has proposed it, the GOP's enthusiasm will disappear. This budget will be rejected by narrow-minded conservative partisans, said Ron Fournier in nationaljournal.com. Just as Ryan's budget, expected next month, will be denounced by stubborn liberals. Both parties fail to recognize that adapting to a global economy, a technological revolution, and a massive social change requires innovative, even radical thinking. The White House and Congress need to find a new formula for stimulating economic growth while helping people adjust to rapidly changing, more competitive world. Unfortunately for Americans, their leaders aren't up to the job. Our controversy of the week. Obama, not tough enough to deter Putin? When President Obama warned last week that there would be consequences if Russia invaded Ukraine, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post, you could hear the laughter all the way from the Kremlin, followed by the rumbling of Russian military vehicles rolling into Crimea. Russian President Vladimir Putin knew Obama did not have the intestinal fortitude to stand up to him, and that he would talk tough but then seize on any opportunity to avoid a confrontation. That's exactly what Obama did in drawing a red line on Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad's use of chemical weapons, a threat that he eagerly dropped when Putin offered to broker a deal with Assad. Putin further humiliated Obama when he gave asylum to NSA leaker Edward Snowden, said John Fund in nationalreview.com. Whenever they've held joint public meetings, Putin's lack of respect for Obama has been blatant, and he dismissively looks away whenever the president speaks, treating him as someone he could dupe or roll over at will. These criticisms have an absurd premise, said Fred Kaplan in slate.com. Short of starting nuclear World War III, exactly was Obama supposed to be tougher with Putin? How was he supposed to be tougher with Putin? The U.S. has little economic or political leverage over Russia. And since Putin's great fear is that he'll keep losing former Soviet republics to the West, there are no credible consequences that would keep Putin from doing whatever it takes to hang on to Ukraine. Back in 2008, Putin told the ostensibly tougher President George W. Bush that Ukraine was a Russian territory, as opposed to a sovereign nation, and Bush meekly shelved his pledge to invite Ukraine into NATO. That same year, Putin brutally invaded Georgia and gave two Russian-leaning provinces within Georgia their independence, while Bush did nothing to stop him. Don't tell that to the muscle-bound, manly men of the right, said Paul Waldman in Prospect.org. Hawkish Republicans like Senator John McCain and the chicken hawks on the conservative talk radio are now ecstatically blaming Putin's aggression on Obama's weakness. Action, they demand. We have to show Putin's who's boss. What action? It doesn't matter. We must be strong, 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 strong. You don't have to go to war to project strength, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. In the 5 years since Obama took office, U.S. foreign policy has undergone a general drift toward retreat and disengagement. Americans are war-weary and increasingly isolationist. So autocratic thugs don't worry when Obama frowns and claims that all options are on the table, because everyone knows his heart isn't in it. From where Putin sits, American power hardly seems in retreat, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com. A dozen former Soviet bloc countries have joined NATO, and the European Union is knocking at Ukraine's door. In short, recent history looks at Putin like one long march by America and its allies closer and closer to the border of Russia itself. It's this deepening sense of his own weakness, not of Obama's, that inspired Putin's desperate lunge to keep Ukraine. A display of masculinity that makes Putin feel even more threatened could backfire, said Benjamin Wallace Wells in NYMag.com. Even the hawks admit that the only way to deter Putin from invading the rest of Ukraine is with economic and political pressure from a unified multinational coalition. The toughest policy we can adopt right now, in other words, looks an awful lot like the kind Obama has always advocated. It was a good week for strolling in Naples after the almost bankrupt Italian city began DNA testing dog feces on its poop-covered sidewalks so it can prosecute residents who don't pick up. I know some people find it funny that with all the problems the city has, we would focus on dog poop, said an official. It was a good week for diversion after a dedicated graffiti zone was set up at the Great Wall of China in the hope it would stop visitors from scratching their names on the historic barrier. Most of the graffiti on the wall, said the Chinese media, is in English. It was a good week for trying anything. After growing numbers of drought-afflicted California farmers began hiring dowsers to locate underground water. Scientists don't believe in it, said vintner Mark Mondavi. But I do, and most of the farmers in the Napa Valley do. It was a bad week for infallibility after Pope Francis accidentally cursed in Italian while delivering his weekly blessing at the Vatican, using the word caso, the equivalent to the F-bomb rather than caso, which means example. It was a bad week for Mississippi, which has overtaken West Virginia as the fattest state in the Union, with an obesity rate of 35.4%. Montana has the lowest obesity rate, 19.6%. And it was a bad week for holy bribery after the Kentucky Baptist Convention started giving away free steak dinners and guns to encourage unchurched young rednecks to come to church and accept Jesus. Can you picture Jesus giving away guns? Asked one disapproving pastor. And while we're here, this blurb under the heading Only in America. A Texas high school student was suspended after he accidentally packed a beer can in his lunch. Chaz Seal said he thought he was packing a soda can and turned the beer into a teacher. But officials sent him to an alternative school for 2 months. I gave it to the teacher thinking I wouldn't get in trouble, Seal said, and I got in trouble. On the briefing page this week, in Russia's shadow, Ukraine has been part of Russia on and off for centuries. Why does Russia feel justified in interfering with its affairs? Why is Ukraine so important to Russia? The two neighboring countries have been intertwined for over 1,000 years of tumultuous history. Today, Ukraine is one of Russia's biggest markets for natural gas exports, a crucial transit route to the rest of Europe, and home to an estimated 7.5 million ethnic Russians, who mostly live in eastern Ukraine and the southern region of Crimea. All told, about 25% of Ukraine's 46 million people claim Russian as their mother tongue. Russia lacks natural borders like rivers and mountains along its western frontier, so its leaders have traditionally seen the maintenance of a sphere of influence over the countries around it as a source of security, said David Clark, chairman of the Russia Foundation, a think tank. That's especially true of Ukraine, which Russia regards as its little brother. Everybody knows that Ukrainians are Russians, said Kremlin advisor Sergei Markov, except for the Galicians, a reference to the Ukrainian-speaking residents of western Ukraine. Why do Russians see Ukraine as theirs? It's partly because both nations trace their roots back to the first East Slavic state, Kievan Rus, which stretched from the Baltic to the Black Sea from the 9th century to the mid-13th century. This medieval empire was founded, oddly enough, by the Vikings. Rus is the Slavic word given to the red-haired Scandinavians who swept down from the north in the 9th century, conquered the local Slavic tribes, and established their capital at Kiev. The kingdom converted to Eastern Orthodox Christianity in 988, laying the foundation of the modern Russian church. A French bishop sent to Ukraine reported, "This land is more unified, happier, stronger, and more civilized than France herself." But in the 13th century, Kiev was devastated by Mongol invaders, and power shifted north to a small Rus trading outpost called Moscow. What happened to Ukraine after Kievan Rus fell? Its territory was carved up by competing powers, who prized the fertile plains and rich dark soil that later earned Ukraine the nickname the breadbasket of Europe. Catholic Poland and Lithuania dominated the country for hundreds of years, but by the end of the 18th century, Imperial Russia had grabbed most of Ukraine, except for Galicia, which was controlled by the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Tsars referred to their dominion as Little Russia and tried to crush surging Ukrainian nationalism in the 1840s, banning the use of the Ukrainian language in schools. How did Ukraine break away? The first independent Ukrainian state was declared in Kiev in 1917, following the collapse of the Russian and Austro-Hungarian empires at the end of World War I. That independence was short-lived. The new country was invaded by Poland and fought over by forces loyal to the Tsar and Moscow's new Bolshevik government, which took power in Russia's 1918 revolution. By the time Ukraine was incorporated into the Soviet Union in 1922, its economy was in tatters and its populace starving. Worse was to come. When Ukrainian peasants refused to join collective farms in the 1930s, Soviet leader Joseph Stalin orchestrated mass executions and a famine that killed up to 10 million people. After Stalin imported millions of Russians and other Soviet citizens to help repopulate the coal and iron ore-rich East. This mass migration, said former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Stephen Pfeiffer, helps explain why the sense of Ukrainian nationalism is not as deep in the East as it is in the West. World War II exacerbated this divide. What happened during the war? When the Nazis invaded Ukraine in 1941, many locals welcomed the Germans as liberators from the Soviets, and tens of thousands even fought alongside them, hoping Adolf Hitler would reward them with an independent state. Later, when the Nazis began using Ukrainians as slave labor, about 2.5 million fought for Stalin's Red Army. The country became one of World War II's bloodiest battlefields. At least 5.3 million Ukrainians died during the war, about one-sixth of the population. About 2.25 million of those killed were Jews, targeted by both the Nazis and some Ukrainian collaborators. At the end of the war, Stalin deported tens of thousands of Ukrainians accused of cooperating with the Nazis to Siberian prison camps and executed thousands more. When did Ukraine become truly independent? In 1991, more than 90% of Ukrainians voted to declare independence from the crumbling Soviet Union. But Russia continued to meddle in the country's affairs. In Ukraine's 2004 presidential election, the Kremlin-backed pro-Russian candidate Viktor Yanukovych. Massive fraud in that election sparked the Orange Revolution, which kept Yanukovych from power. The failure of subsequent leaders led to Yanukovych's making a comeback in 2010. But after he canceled a trade deal with the European Union, he was driven from office again last month by pro-Western demonstrators. Despite the world's outrage, Russian President Vladimir Putin is unlikely to let Ukraine leave his country's orbit. Russia without Ukraine is a country, explains Daniel Dresner, an international politics professor at Tufts University. Russia with Ukraine is an empire. And here we had the best columns from the U.S. First from Greg Hampikian at the New York Times. Bringing guns to college. Now that state legislators want to let armed students in my college classroom, said Boise State University professor Greg Hampikian, I have a practical question. When may I shoot a student? Until now, I've never considered bringing a gun to work. But Idaho's legislature thinks it will make us all safer if students can carry firearms. So to even the playing field, I should get one too. But what are the rules of classroom engagement? Over the years, I've been confronted by a fair number of angry and distraught students. If an agitated student reaches into his backpack while disputing a grade, may I stand my ground? Whip out my weapon and fire? Given my aging reflexes, I'd like to be proactive. If two armed students are arguing at the coffee bar, can I avert a serious firefight by shooting them in the legs? Admittedly, these are difficult questions, but encouraging guns on campus makes so much sense. What a fine way to teach responsibility to thousands of hormone-filled young people experimenting with drugs, sex, alcohol, and now, guns. Lock and load, everyone. From L. Gordon Krovitz at the Wall Street Journal, Big Brother in the Newsroom. When journalists discovered that the Federal Communications Commission planned to study the internal practices of newsrooms, said L. Gordon Krovitz, they were justifiably furious. Thanks to the First Amendment, the government has no business meddling with journalism. The FCC quickly dropped its study. And in one sense, that's a pity. Had government agents arrived in newsrooms asking pointed questions about bias and who decides what stories get covered, real topics on the FCC's agenda, journalists might have gotten a taste of the kind of government overreach every other industry routinely experiences. Court-appointed monitors, for example, are now seeking to interview Apple employees and executives about their internal decisions about pricing e-books. The Federal Trade Commission is requiring that Facebook, Google, and Twitter let it second-guess their business practices for the next 20 years. The FCC is now even seeking to regulate internet service providers to make sure they charge all customers equally, regardless of how much data they download. Maybe if the FCC had barged into a few newsrooms, journalists would understand how it feels to be micromanaged by bureaucrats. And finally, from Cynthia Tucker at AJC.com, the real alternative to Obamacare. If you want to know the Republican alternative to Obamacare, said Cynthia Tucker, Georgia has it. Our state's governor, Nathan Deal, has rejected the Affordable Care Act's expansion of Medicaid to the poor, even though the federal government would pick up 100% of the costs for 3 years. As a result, state hospitals will continue to be forced to absorb the cost of treating hundreds of thousands of Georgians who have no health insurance. The governor admits this will put a severe strain on hospitals, so he now has proposed a solution. Change federal law so that hospitals can turn away the uninsured. What a brilliant solution. No care at all. Congressional Republicans keep promising to pass a formal alternative to the ACA, but never do so for a simple reason. Their powerful Tea Party faction will only support alternatives in which our nation allows the uninsured poor to die. This is one reason why a new Kaiser poll found that 56% of Americans want to keep the ACA, while just 31% want it repealed. People have figured out what repeal really means. Let them die. And we'll turn now to the last word, our in-depth article. Do atoms play? The free movement of atoms, said David Graeber, may give rise to play in animals and to the human mind. My friend June Thunderstorm and I once spent a half an hour sitting in a meadow by a mountain lake, watching an inchworm dangle from the top of a stalk of grass, twist about in every possible direction, and then leap to the next stalk and do the same thing. And so it proceeded in a vast circle with what must have been a vast expenditure of energy for what seemed like absolutely no reason at all. All animals play, June had once said to me, even ants. She'd spent many years working as a professional gardener and had plenty of incidents like this to observe and ponder. Look, she said, with an air of modest triumph, see what I mean? Most of us, hearing this story, would insist on proof. How do we know the worm was playing? Perhaps the invisible circles traced in the air were really just a search for some unknown sort of prey. Or a mating ritual. Can we prove they weren't? Even if the worm was playing, how do we know this form of play did not serve some ultimately practical purpose, exercise, or self-training for some possible future inchworm emergency? This would be the reaction of most professional ethologists as well. Generally speaking, an analysis of animal behavior is not considered scientific unless the animal is assumed, at least tacitly, to be operating according to the same means, ends, calculations that one would apply to economic transactions. Under this assumption, an expenditure of energy must be directed towards some goal, whether it be obtaining food, securing territory, achieving dominance, or maximizing reproductive success, unless one can absolutely prove that it isn't. An absolute proof in such matters is, as one might imagine, very hard to come by. Despite all this, those who do look into the matter are invariably forced to the conclusion that play does exist across the animal universe. And it exists not just among such notoriously frivolous creatures as monkeys, dolphins, or puppies, but among such unlikely species as frogs, minnows, salamanders, fiddler crabs, and yes, even ants, which not only engage in frivolous activities as individuals, but also have been observed since the 19th century to arrange mock wars, apparently just for the fun of it. Why do animals play? Well, why shouldn't they? The real question is, why does the existence of action carried out for the sheer pleasure of acting, the exertion of powers for the sheer pleasure of exerting them, strike us as mysterious? What does it tell us about ourselves that we instinctively assume that it is? The tendency in popular thought to view the biological world in economic terms was present at the 19th century beginnings of Darwinian science. Charles Darwin, after all, borrowed the term survival of the fittest from the sociologist Herbert Spencer, that darling of robber barons. competition over resources, rational calculation of advantage, and the gradual extinction of the weak were taken to be the prime directives of the universe. The stakes of this new view of nature as the theater for a brutal struggle for existence were high, and objections registered very early on. An alternative school of Darwinism emerged in Russia, emphasizing cooperation, not competition, as the driver of evolutionary change. In 1902, this approach found a voice in the popular book Mutual Aid, A Factor of Evolution, by naturalist and revolutionary anarchist pamphleteer Peter Kropotkin. In an explicit riposte to social Darwinist, Kropotkin argued that those species that cooperate most effectively tend to be the most competitive in the long run. The Russian challenge was taken quite seriously in the 20th century biology, even if it was rarely mentioned by name. It came instead to be subsumed under the broader problem of altruism. This was the question that already troubled Darwin. Why should animals ever sacrifice their individual advantage for others? Because no one can deny that they sometimes do. Why should a herd animal draw potentially lethal attention to himself by alerting his fellows a predator is coming? Why should worker bees kill themselves to protect their hive? If to advance a scientific explanation of any behavior means to attribute rational, maximizing motives, then what precisely was a kamikaze bee trying to maximize? We all know the eventual answer, which the discovery of genes made possible. Animals were simply trying to maximize the propagation of their own genetic code. The epitome of this line of thought came with the militant atheist Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, a work that insisted all biological entities were best conceived of as lumbering robots, programmed by genetic codes that, for some reason no one could quite explain, acted like successful Chicago gangsters, ruthlessly expanding their territory in an endless desire to propagate themselves. This, anyway, is how the Russian challenge was understood. Kropotkin's actual argument is far more interesting. Much of it, for instance, is concerned with how animal cooperation often has nothing to do with survival or reproduction, but is a form of pleasure in itself. To take flight in flocks merely for pleasure is quite common among all sorts of birds, he writes. Kropotkin multiplies examples of social play. Pairs of vultures wheeling about for their own entertainment. Hares so keen to box with other species that they occasionally and unwisely approach foxes. Flocks of birds performing military-style maneuvers. Bands of squirrels coming together for wrestling and similar games. To exercise one's capacities to their fullest extent is to take pleasure in one's own existence. And with sociable creatures, such pleasures are proportionally magnified when performed in company. From the Russian perspective, this does not need to be explained. It is simply what life is. We don't have to explain why creatures desire to be alive. Life is an end in itself. And if what being alive actually consists of is having powers, to run, jump, fight, fly through the air, then surely the exercise of such powers as an end in itself does not have to be explained either. It's just an extension of the same principle. Friedrich Schiller had already argued in 1795 that it was precisely in play that we find the origins of self-consciousness, and hence freedom, and hence morality. Man plays only when he is in the full sense of the word a man, Schiller wrote in his On the Aesthetic Education of Man, and he is only wholly a man when he is playing. If so, and if Kropotkin was right, then glimmers of freedom, or even of moral life, begin to appear everywhere around us. What would happen if we agreed to treat play not as some peculiar anomaly, but as our starting point? a principle already present, not just in all living creatures, but also on every level where we find what physicists, chemists, and biologists refer to as self-organizing systems. Philosophers of science, faced with the puzzle of how life might emerge from dead matter, or how conscious beings might evolve from microbes, had developed two types of explanations. The first consists of what's called emergentism. The argument here is that once a certain level of complexity is reached, there is a qualitative leap where completely new sorts of physical laws can emerge, ones that are premised on, but cannot be reduced to, what came before. In this way, the laws of biology emerge from chemistry. One obviously needs to understand the chemical components of a fish to understand how it swims, but chemical components will never provide a full explanation. In the same way, the human mind can be said to be emergent from the cells that make it up. Those who hold the second position, usually called panpsychism or panexperientialism, agree that all this may be true, but argue that emergence is not enough. As British philosopher Galen Strawson recently put it, to imagine that one can travel from insensate matter to being capable of discussing the existence of insensate matter in a mere two jumps is simply to make emergence do too much work. Something has to be there already, on every level of material existence, even that of subatomic particles. Something, however minimal and embryonic, that does some of the things we are used to thinking of life, and even mind, as doing. In order for that something to be organized on more and more complex levels to eventually produce self-conscious beings, that something might be very minimal indeed, some very rudimentary sense of responsiveness to one's environment. Something like anticipation, something like memory. All sorts of questions are at stake in the debate, including the hoary problem of free will. If the movements of the particles that make up our brains are already determined by natural laws, then how can we be said to have free will? The standard answer is that we have known since Heisenberg that the movements of atomic particles are not predetermined. Quantum physics can predict to which position electrons, for instance, will tend to jump in aggregate in a given situation, but it is impossible to predict which way any particular electron will jump in any particular instance. Problem solved. Except not really. Something's still missing. If all this means is that the particles which make up our brains jump around randomly, one would still have to imagine some immaterial, metaphysical entity, the mind, that intervenes to guide the neurons in non-random directions. But that would be circular. You'd need to already have a mind to make your brain act like a mind. If those motions are not random, in contrast, you can at least begin to think about a material explanation, and the presence of endless forms of self-organization in nature, structures maintaining themselves in equilibrium within their environments, from electromagnetic fields to processes of crystallization, does give panpsychists a great deal of material to work with. Let us imagine a principle. Call it a principle of freedom or, since Latinate constructions tend to carry more weight in such matters, call it a principle of ludic freedom. Let us imagine it to hold that the free exercise of an entity's most complex powers or capacities will, under certain circumstances at least, tend to become an end in itself. It would obviously not be the only principle active in nature. Others pull other ways, but if nothing else, it would help explain what we actually observe, such as why, despite the second law of thermodynamics, the universe seems to be getting more rather than less complex. Evolutionary psychologists claim they can explain, as the title of one recent book has it, why sex is fun. What they can't explain is why fun is fun. This could. I'm not saying that the position I'm suggesting here, that there is a play principle at the basis of all physical reality, is necessarily true. I would just insist that such a perspective is at least as plausible as the weirdly inconsistent speculations that currently pass for orthodoxy, in which a mindless robotic universe, suddenly produces poets and philosophers out of nowhere. The author David Graeber is a contributing editor at The Baffler. The complete version of this article first appeared in The Baffler and is reprinted by permission. We'll flip back now to the Health and Science page. Turning the corner on childhood obesity. Finally, some good news in America's battle with obesity. A major survey by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that obesity rates among children ages 2 to 5 fell 43% over the past decade, the first significant decline in a condition that can lead to myriad health problems. Obesity rates among preschoolers dropped to just above 8% in 2012, down from nearly 14% in 2004. Obesity rates in other age groups remained largely unchanged, but lowered rates among kids bode well for the future, scientists say. Overweight toddlers are 5 times more likely to be obese as adults, putting them at higher risk for cancer, heart disease, stroke, and other illnesses. This is the first time we've seen any indication of any significant decrease in any group, CDC epidemiologist Cynthia Ogden tells the New York Times. Though unable to pinpoint the reasons for the decline, researchers cited several factors. Children are consuming fewer sugary drinks, more women are breastfeeding, which correlates to a healthier weight range in young children, and thanks in part to a national campaign spearheaded by Michelle Obama, many child care centers are offering more nutritious foods and opportunities for exercise. The health scare of the week. Vitamins could backfire. People who take vitamin and mineral supplements may not be boosting their health and could actually be raising their risk of cancer and heart disease. That's the conclusion of a new report by the U.S. Preventive Science Services Task Force, which raised questions about the efficacy of $28 billion Americans spend on supplements. If you're taking supplements, you're doing so on the basis of hope, not science, Task Force co-vice chairman Dr. Michael Lefevre tells NPR.org. After reviewing dozens of studies, researchers found inadequate evidence to support the idea that supplements benefit healthy adults. But there was strong evidence that beta-carotene can actually increase the risk of lung cancer for those prone to the disease due to smoking or exposure to asbestos. Nearly half of all U.S. adults take at least one vitamin or mineral supplement on a regular basis. More research is needed to determine whether vitamins have any beneficial health effects, the task force said. On the Talking Points page, gentrification. Bad for the neighborhood? I have a terrible confession to make, said Joshua Greenman in the New York Daily News. I'm a white, college-educated young guy who moved to a rundown neighborhood in Brooklyn in 1995, when property prices were rising. And now I enjoy the borough's locally brewed beer, fresh roasted coffee, and artisanal pickles. That makes me a gentrifier, which means, to Spike Lee, I'm the enemy. In an expletive-filled rant at a public talk last week, the film director bitterly complained about the white newcomers allegedly ruining his old Brooklyn neighborhood. An influx of mother-blanking hipsters has sent rents soaring, Lee said. Banning the noisy black parties black neighbors once enjoyed and doing the local neighbors and doing to the locals what Christopher Columbus once did to Native Americans. These are the words of a grouchy bigot, said John McWhorter in Time.com. Black Brooklynites are making good money selling property to newcomers, and a once sketchy neighborhood is on the rise. And this is a bad thing? Why? You're missing Lee's point, said Kia Makarichi in HuffingtonPost.com. It's not the mere presence of white people that angers him, but that the government didn't care about those neighborhoods when their only residents were black. Why did it take this great influx of white people to get the schools better? He demanded. Why is the garbage getting picked up more regularly? The answer is obvious. Blacks are still second-class citizens. Gentrification doesn't have to create such tension, said Jason Reynolds in Gawker.com. New arrivals need to stop thinking of Bed-Stuy and Fort Greene as places in need of civilizing and appreciate the rich multicultural stew that's been there for decades. So sit on the stoop, speak to your neighbors, and for God's sake, dance at the block party. You won't see Lee at the block party, said Errol Lewis in the Daily News. He sold his Brooklyn home for $1 million in the late 1990s to a banker and an attorney and decamped to Manhattan's wealthy white Upper East Side. But he continued promoting the hipness of black Brooklyn in his movies and used his wealth to buy, renovate, and sell properties in the area, fueling the blazing fire of gentrification. There's nothing wrong with Lee's real estate opportunism, but how can he complain so bitterly about the very Brooklyn he helped create? The Tea Party, 5 years of disruption. 5 years ago, not many people knew of Ted Cruz or sequestration or had seen a tricorn hat, said Tom Cohen in CNN.com. Then the Tea Party burst onto the scene, transforming American politics with its Revolutionary War-era garb, insistent demands for fiscal conservatism and small government, and unyielding resistance to tax increases of any kind. The movement enabled Republicans to recapture the House of Representatives in 2010 before instigating a series of dramatic showdowns with President Obama and the Democratic-controlled Senate. 5 years on, the party is over, said John Stanton in BuzzFeed.com. Today's movement is rudderless, and those high-profile showdowns, culminating in an unpopular 16-day government shutdown in October, have permanently tarnished Tea Partiers as obstructionists and extremists. Republican House Speaker John Boehner now openly defies Tea Party demands and recently helped Democrats pass a clean debt ceiling increase and a bipartisan budget. The media's outlandish attacks on the Tea Party have certainly taken their toll, said Dan Gaynor in FoxNews.com. Tea Partiers have been labeled racist, homophobic, and wingnuts, all because they dared to challenge Obamacare, the $787 billion stimulus, and big government. But despite those unwarranted smears, the movement has achieved its core aims, said Joel Pollack in Breitbart.com. Over the last 5 years, the Tea Party has blocked Obama's attempts at massive new spending and sparked a national debate on entitlement reform. The Republican Party needs the movement for ideological coherence and grassroots support, and America needs the Tea Party as well. That all depends, said Peter Winter in CommentaryMagazine.com. The movement arose from a justifiable concern over the size of the federal government, but it hasn't always channeled populist anger in a constructive way. Tea Partiers have become obsessed with excommunicating Republicans whom they deem to be ideologically impure in primary challenges and replacing them with unelectable demagogues. The Tea Party still has the potential to be a hugely positive force in American politics if it focuses on promoting common sense, conservative reforms. But if it becomes more and more apocalyptic in its rhetoric and outlook, the movement will ultimately self-destruct. And a few notes to finish up. Leonardo DiCaprio has been nominated for 4 Oscars, but has lost every time. After he failed to win the Best Actor award for The Wolf of Wall Street this week, he was widely mocked on Twitter alongside the hashtag Poor Leo. U.S. regional airlines are facing a pilot shortage due to low salaries. Starting pilot salaries at 14 U.S. regional carriers average $22,400 a year, with some paying just $15,000, that is, the minimum wage. While 96% of university chief academic officers said they were confident in their institution's ability to prepare students for success in the workforce, only 11% of business leaders strongly agree. 80% of conservative Republicans believe that most people can get ahead if they work hard, compared with just 36% of liberal Democrats. 62% of liberal Democrats believe that the government programs can do a lot to reduce poverty, compared with just 21% of conservative Republicans. And maybe that begs the quote that we're going to finish with. Nothing can take the sting off the world's economic problems like watching millionaires present each other golden statues. That's from Billy Crystal, quoted in the Montreal Gazette. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.